This is the UK Energy Research Centre podcast.
Hi, I'm Rob Gross, Director of the UK Energy Research Centre, and you're listening to our podcast, Talking Energy. Today, I am delighted to be joined by Dimitrios Papathanasiou. And Dimitrios is Global Director of Energy and Extractives at the World Bank, and by Alex O'Kinnaid, who is the founder and CEO of Gore Street Capital. I'll ask them to say a few words about themselves and what they do in their respective organisations in a moment. But today we want to explore the crucial topic of investment in electricity storage as an enabler of expanding renewables and electricity grids around the world. And UKIRC has a lot of interest in both of these topics, working extensively on the evolution of grids and on how policy drives investment in clean energy. So I'm really, really interested in these very, very different but equally important perspectives that we brought into today's podcast. Welcome both. I'll start with Alex, actually. Alex, Gore Street is one of our leading storage developers internationally. Can you tell me a little bit about Gore Street and your own journey into sustainable energy?
Thank you, Rob, and thank you for inviting me. So I've been investing into renewables since about 2006. So I'm a private equity professional focusing on the world of renewables. Started investing when I was head of investments for Masdar, which is an Abu Dhabi government sovereign fund. So I was out in the Middle East running those investing activities from 2006 to 2013. Came back into the European marketplace. And though I brought back a kind of a large set of experiences of solar, wind, waste to energy, right? This kind of gamut of renewable technology and renewable infrastructure investing. I didn't really think that the world needed another wind investor or another solar investor. And so myself and my colleagues in 2015, when we founded Gore Street, were looking for an asset class which we believed would be material to our energy transition. We wanted to do something that was material. There's no point not. And we wanted to be able to, you know, look at an asset class which has complexity, has materiality, and to be able to build our franchise on that. I would say we were very fortunate in that we'd chosen energy storage as that asset class. It has absolutely outpaced even our expectations for that materiality. So, and for sure, as we'll get into, I'm sure, on this podcast, it does have a level of complexity associated with it. So we started investing then in energy storage back then in 2015, and we've grown our portfolio to probably one of the world's largest portfolios in energy storage in that time.
Thanks, Alex. That's super interesting. We're going to come back to some of the things you started to touch on there. Dimitrios, tell me a bit about your journey and also about your role at the World Bank and what the bank is doing to encourage investment in clean energy, renewables, storage, and so on.
Thanks a lot, Robin. It's really good to see you again. First of all, the bank has been significantly shifting its attention in clean energy. This has been going on for a number of years, and it has certainly accelerated in the last few years, I would say. And if you look actually at our climate change action plan that we issued back in 2021, we have identified energy storage as one of the key areas that we need to be doing much more if we want to get the whole of the world to reach net zero targets and if the world can meet the Paris Agreement targets as well. So we actually launched the bank back in 2019. We formally launched the Energy Storage Partnership. And through the Energy Storage Partnerships, we try to do three essential things. First of all, we have a key area, which is knowledge, and that is generate our own knowledge and then gather, curate, and disseminate best practices, both on the policy side, on the investment side, financial instruments, and technologies as they develop, because that is a fast-moving target. And make sure that we gather good knowledge and then we make that knowledge, we curate it, and we make it available in various forms to our countries in the developing world. Then the second item that we have been doing is that we help countries in developing strategies, developing policies, doing feasibility studies, planning exercises, depending on how advanced or not they are in the system so that they can best identify what is it that they should be doing in the systems so that they can accelerate clean energy investments, including storage, but primarily wind, solar, and to a large extent in the countries where we work in, network expansion is an issue. We have countries where demand grows very fast. And in the case of Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa especially, we have a huge amount of people who are not even connected. So it's a very diverse set of challenges depending on the country and the part of the world that we're in. But overall, the target is to make sure that we help countries move as fast as possible towards a net zero future. And then the third part, of course, that we're doing under the Energy Storage Partnership is support with our own funding, investments, and support and promote private sector investments, either by providing de-risking facilities and covering various types of risks on these investments that we can probably discuss in more detail later. And I think just to put in the context some of the numbers, when we launched the partnership back in 2019, we committed that we will try and finance about 5,000 megawatt hours of storage, modern storage in the world. And we are well on track to reach that target by 2025. And we said that we would mobilize at least $2 billion into energy storage-related investments. And we're also well on track on meeting this by 2025 as well. So what is also remarkable is, of course, the demand that we see from countries, both on the knowledge side, but also on understanding best what is happening with technologies, what are the costs of technologies, of course, and what is it that technologies can or cannot do for their own systems and their particular circumstances. And it's a tremendous amount of interest that we're seeing.
That's great, Dimitris. Just a quick follow-up question, which is around when you said you de-risk, I'll come back to what that means, but and you co-invest. So which kind of countries would you be co-investing?
Everyone. So in all the countries that can borrow from the World Bank, we can invest, and in many, many countries we are investing. So that ranges from supporting storage and renewable energy at the level of mini grids so that we can increase access in sub-Saharan Africa, all the way to large-scale interventions, both on the policy side and on the investment and the de-risking side, for instance, in larger countries, say in India, which is a huge and fast-growing market, in Latin America, many of the small island development states, which is a great opportunity to apply some of this energy storage technology, especially on the battery side, and so on and so forth.
Okay, that's great.
It's a huge amount of applications, sizes of projects, depending on the particular country and the circumstances.
Yeah, and we tend to kind of say developing countries and make that a kind of a catch-all thing. But of course, what we're really talking about is all of the vast different economic circumstances of countries around the world that don't happen to be the richest and most advanced countries in the world. So Alex, I'll come back to you on and just try and see if we can kind of play these two things together. So if you're considering a move into a new market, you and I were talking about potential new markets just recently. What do you consider? What do you look for? Is it do you want a policy? Does the government have to give you a big bag of cash, or is it the market design, or what kinds of things?
Big bags of cash are always welcome, but we haven't to date. What I would say, to be a good investor in renewables, you need to understand finance, technology, and policy. Right. This is a really interesting set of, a Venn diagram, which you need to be at the center of to be able to deploy capital correctly, and even more so for storage. We started investing in Britain for many years. Britain, I say Britain, England, Scotland, Wales, kind of the national grid footprint, was the leading market for energy storage, really through the way the national grid had set up a set of auctions that allowed energy storage owners such as ourselves to have visibility about how we would make money and how long we would make money. So we started investing there 2016, our first asset, Bulby, which we still own, a 6-megawatt asset up in the north of England. At the time it was commissioned, I think it was one of the largest assets in the world, doing grid balancing. We moved into the Irish market in 2019, which is a fundamentally different differently organized energy system. So Air Grid, which is the grid operator in Republic and Northern Ireland, it's one grid, the island, had, like National Grid, put up a series of policy moves and auctions which allowed us to have confidence to invest. They're organized differently. It's a very different type of contract, but one that we as investors could work out, you know, how it would work for us and how we would generate the appropriate return for our investors. We moved into the Texas market early last year. We moved into the German market early last year. And this year we moved into the Californian market. All differently organized energy systems, all with a set of clearly understood mechanisms for how we participated in the grid balancing market in the main, but also all markets which are undergoing a very significant boom in solar and wind. Really, the macro theme here is if you keep building more and more solar and wind, which obviously we need to do to deal with our incredibly difficult climate problem, you will need storage to balance out, right? So that's the driver. We look for where there is large amounts of solar and wind being added to a grid. We look where that percentage is getting higher and higher versus the percentage of traditional generation. And we know storage is will be required then. The services that storage can deliver are required to keep the grid functioning correctly. So our assets in operation are providing this critical service. And that then leads to our investment decision becoming easier and easier. I think it's really interesting, though, and maybe we'll talk more about this, you know, the idea of investing in the global south and developing countries in renewables has always got this trap, right, which is that, you know, the CapEx for building solar, wind or storage is the same whether you're building in California or whether you're building in, you know, a developing market. And therefore, your returns should be more or less the same. But of course, private investors will require a higher return for investing in an African country than they would in Germany. And so how do we get away from that trap? And so we're not investing at the moment in the developing markets. We're very focused on Western Europe and North America. But I think that's where entities such as the World Bank have to play, you know, this role to de-risk the investment, to actually smooth out that return profile for the international investor. But renewables, given it's all CapEx, is really at the forefront, I think, of how we need to kind of solve that problem.
Okay. Brilliant segue for me into my next question for Demetrios, which is, can you just unpack a bit the mechanics? You mentioned de-risking. I know the bank talks about catalyzing private investment. So, and you make loans, right? But you make loans to governments, and how do you kind of sit alongside private investors? Demystify right. This.
I think the starting point for this conversation is, again, the world's target of coming as quickly as possible to net zero. Because if we go on the way we're going today, we're going to be in deep trouble. Then if you do the exercise, and you know many entities have been doing that, where you set the net zero target by 2050, and then you try to work backwards what needs to happen on the energy mix, and then from that energy mix, trying to calculate what you're going to need in terms of investments. I think we've done the calculations and we're not coming very far off others. And what we're seeing is that whereas today, if you look at investments that go into the global south, the countries that we serve, we're at around maybe $250 billion a year without China, because China is such a huge entity that introduces a lot of different numbers on the system. We calculated that by 2030, for the world to get to net zero, we will need to ramp up this 240, 250 billion that we have today to about a trillion year after year. So we're talking about for a very significant scaling up of investment. And because the numbers are so huge and the needs are so enormous, the natural thing to the way to do that is that this needs to bring all sources of capital. But of course, primarily, it needs to be private capital. And the reason it needs to be private capital is because it is private capital that is financing energy around the world today. So what we need to find out is, how do we get this private capital that mostly keeps on going on fossil fuels, what will it take so that this capital is redirected towards clean energy? And again, just to put things a little bit into perspective, the world today, if you look at what is spent across the world on coal, on oil, and on natural gas, which covers, say, around 80% of the world's primary energy needs. We're looking at investments that, especially last year with the spikes in fossil fuel prices, they go well above $10 trillion a year in recurring spending on burning stuff. This is globally. We did the calculation for the focus countries where we said we need to mobilize about $1 trillion a year by 2030. And we calculated that already in the countries that we were targeting, and that excludes China, their spending on fuels, on fossil fuels, just for the power sector, the electricity sector alone, is about $500 billion. And this is recurrent spending that goes into burning fossil fuels. If we find a way that we make this recurrent spending into servicing the financing needs, the equity and the debt that goes into clean energy investments, even that enormous figure of $1 trillion per year is not as big anymore. And I think the whole challenge that we're facing on our side as a development institution and as we help countries to do the policies and to then support them with our funding, but also to leverage financing from others, is what is it that we need to be putting in place so that capital can come in and get the returns instead and get the financing so that they get the returns rather than the funding is spent on burning fossil fuels. This is what we call the real scaling up to phase down. We have to find a way to scale up the investments on clean energy. This is primarily a financial transaction and financial structuring question. As Alex said, and I fully agree with him, it depends on technology and policies, because financing follows technology and policy inevitably. And then once we get this ramping up of clean energy investments, then we can start phasing down and have a meaningful conversation about how quickly can we phase down coal and then natural gas as well. So I think the numbers are significant. It is a great opportunity for investors because we need huge amounts of capital. And to the extent that energy is one of the necessities of life, it's one of the necessities of economic growth and of economic activity, these types of investment should be, in essence, be considered secure investment, because people will always be spending money for energy. Now, the question is, how do we put in place the right systems, the right structures in the institutions, so that the spending that people anyway have to make for energy services, rather than being eventually directed to fossil fuels, is directed towards electricity and therefore clean electricity in the end. And I think this is a lot of what we try to do. Now, that's a very long introduction to point out that it is all very possible. The needs and the financial investments that need to take place are enormous, but the fundamentals are there and can be placed. Now, to come to Alex's point about how risks are differently perceived in the Global South and in OECD countries, this is all starting from the point of what is the cost of capital for each one of these countries. And the cost of capital is primarily associated with the credibility of every country in terms of repaying its debts and repaying its obligations. And that is where, because of the different levels of development, the different levels of institutional structures and all that, that is where we see the risks and the risk perceptions among countries to diverge a lot. So this is, I think, where we need to figure out why is divergence as significant as it is today, and whether energy, and especially clean energy investments, can find ways to bridge that gap that we have between the cost of capital, say, in an OECD country, and then the cost of capital in an African country as well.
Okay, so just to kind of to follow up on that a bit, so just to use a country, for example, because you mentioned it, and not for any particular reason, let's take India. So we know that India's had a lot of growth in solar, and it's actually one of the early leads in wind, right? Some states in India, I think it was Tamil Nadu, had policy supports in place for wind right back into the 1990s. So how could we create the kinds of conditions, and what would the bank's role be in trying to enable this, that Alex mentioned, that first got him and his colleagues to start their company up to build to raise capital and to build projects in the Great Britain market. What would the mechanics be, and what would the bank be doing to try and, let's say, create those kinds of conditions for storage in India, where they must be needing it, or maybe there are already projects being built? I'm not close enough to that.
India is a very special case among the countries that we work in. It's extremely interesting case because it has managed, I would say, in the last decade or so, to make very significant progress on clean energy. And this is happening in a country where demand is growing very fast and where the economy is growing very fast as well. So what the Indians have been doing, and we worked with them both in helping them with thinking through their policies, but also in making some investments, is trying to figure out what would be the best way so that India can deliver affordable, reliable, and sustainable energy for their people. And especially for India, but for most of the countries where we work in, the issue of affordability is a really big one. It has to be cheap. It has to be affordable for people if it is to be successful. And the way that India has structured their successful growth in the solar program is by essentially organizing auctions and organizing them in a way and at a scale that it became quite attractive to investors. So they provided some policy measures in terms of how power is to be evacuated, and then they provided additional kind of security instruments to make sure that the projects that take place and deliver energy will be paid for whatever energy is contracted. And this is probably one of the most difficult risks to deal with in the countries where we work in, because the financial viability of the sector as a whole is not as strong as you would have, for instance, in the UK. I think when Alex invests in a project and they have to come into a bid, they need to make all their assessments. But I think one assessment that they don't really need to make is whether they will eventually get paid for what they produce. And in the countries where we are, we really have to figure out an instrument that can reassure investors that they will get paid, even if the companies that they're dealing with go bankrupt. And very often these are state-owned entities. So it becomes a bit of a complex way of trying to provide reassurance on that. Yeah. And once we deal with all of this, especially if it comes from outside investors, we have to think about, can you get paid in the currency that you've invested in? And that's a separate conversation as well.
Alex, I sense that you want to come in on this, so please do.
Yeah. So I think I have there's two comments to that. One is general about renewables, and then one about storage in particular. Renewables is just different, right? So, you know, with hydrocarbon generation, you have some CapEx, but your feedstock is not free, right? So the investment decision is one which you can control a large amount of your expenditure on, given different changes in the credit situation, right? Whereas with renewables, you build something, it's very hard to move it, and you know your feedstock is free, right? So the solar and wind. But you know, I was investing in Spain in 2008, and in 2008. We had hundreds of millions invested into solar in Spain, and the Spanish government retroactively changed the agreement. So this is not just a global South perspective, right? So Spain, and you know, was going through an existential crisis. They couldn't pay their teachers and nurses, so I understood what their movements were about. But they absolutely, as sovereign, decided to change the rules, and led to a very significant loss for a group of international investors which had piled into the Spanish market. So interestingly enough, our contracts, in essence, in all the markets we're operating, are not so much governmental contracts, right? We are contracting with the grid operator. Now, in Ireland, the grid operator is owned by the state, but in GB, it's not, you know, in lots of the markets we're in, they're not. So we're providing a commercial service to another commercial entity. We would prefer that, to be honest, and providing a service to a sovereign which might have other criteria by which it changes the rules. You know, we're confident the national grid will pay its bills because it needs our service and it's creditworthy. I think in storage in particular, it's quite interesting because what storage gives you is the ability to do many different types of things. If you own solar and wind, You're producing electrons and you're selling electrons. You hope the price that you sell electrons will cover your investment plus margin, right? In storage, we are providing multiple different types of services to the grid, all different types of auctions, different types of activities. We're also providing backup in terms of capacity and the capacity auctions, which are governmental contracts, but we're also wholesale trading, right? We're trading electricity, a differential between day and night. So as an investor, we can look to manage our risk of investing in a location, whether it be Ireland, Germany, UK, Texas, or India, by saying, well, what are we going to do with the asset? How many different opportunities is there for us to generate a return? And who are we generating? Who is our counterparty for that? In lots of those cases, there are multiple counterparties. And so that then allows us to really kind of de-risk a lot of the investment decision. What it does do, though, it adds a huge amount more complexity. So energy storage, I think, is at the, and I would say this as a leading energy, in a leading energy storage firm, is the probably the most complex end of the spectrum of renewables, because we're doing multiple things. We have multiple different counterparties. But all of that leads then, I think, to a much stronger investment case for private sector.
But could you imagine that investment case transferring into a developing country context anytime soon?
For sure. And absolutely, there's assets being built. But I think to mobilize private capital, if we're generating a 10% return in Germany, how much return do we need to generate in India? It's got to be more than 10%, right? And if the CapEx is the same, we're either charging more for our services in a poorer country, which is just morally wrong anyway, right? Or there is another entity which is making up that difference in return to us. And that is where we would look to the World Bank or the Green Climate Fund or, you know, many, many excellent institutions which are trying to do that, to mobilize it. But it's that differential. We, you know, international investors will make a decision about where to place capital. And we understand Germany. We understand the rule of law, right? We do. The credit worthiness is strong. Therefore, in the same return, you'd invest in Germany rather than India. So something else needs to happen.
Got it. Any comments on that, Demetrius?
I agree with Alex. And the fact of the matter is, as a starting point, one can look at, you know, what is the cost of capital when a country issues their bonds, which is the safest type of investment. And the fact of the matter remains that when a poor country issues bonds, they have to pay more for getting capital compared to its country. And when it comes to the energy sector, though, I think there are two considerations to put on the table. The first consideration is that the externalities of promoting clean energy in the developing world and in the global south are very strong. The reality is that unless we get the global south to move effectively and quickly towards net zero, we're all going to have a problem. So that is one issue that should be on the table, and that there have been ideas and approaches, and even the Paris Agreement, Article 6 talks about how do we do carbon trading. But the fact of the matter is that this has not advanced and it needs to be unlocked so that some additional resources can be put on the table and reduce this gap that we have between the cost of capital in a place like Germany and the cost of capital in a place like, say, South Africa. So that's number one. Then the second item is, how do you deal with the fact, and Alex mentioned the case of Spain that went into crisis. My comment on that is that it really took a global financial crisis for this to happen. So that, in principle, should be a black swan event, a really rare event.
Or once every 10 years.
But it did happen. It affected investments. And, you know, being a Greek, I can tell you that still the repercussions of that crisis can be felt here. So it has been bad, and inevitably, you know, if something like that happens, everybody's affected. So it's not just energy, everything will be affected. But beyond that, I think what we are trying to do as a World Bank group is we have instruments for political insurance. So for instance, we can work with our colleagues at MIGA, the Multilateral Investment Guarantee Agency, that can actually provide insurance in case you have a change in government and government wants, say, to expropriate things or not comply with terms of the contract that they've signed. We actually have our colleagues at the IFC, the International Finance Corporation, that can co-invest with the private sector, providing debt or in some cases providing equity and other types of, you know, a bit more complex and fancy financial instruments to make things happen. And on the side of the World Bank, what we try and do is, first of all, as much as possible, make sure that countries have the right policies in place so that investors look at a country and they say, okay, if I invest in the sector, this is what I will be, this is what I expect to be paid, this is how I will be paid, this is how my services will be valued. And that's really, really important. And then we try to make sure that if, for instance, investments in the grid are needed, so the grid needs to be reinforced, or if we need to have instrumentation in a grid so that we can capture information in a way so that investors can be properly reimbursed, then we can help with that. So we try to put all these elements of the puzzle together at all levels so that we can then attract the private investment in. I have to say that lately, because of the very proactive policies that we see in the United States and increasingly now in Europe, when it comes to promoting clean energy, I do expect that our job in getting, let's say, international investors to look at the Global South is becoming harder and harder, because the incentives that are in place, especially in the United States, but I think increasingly Europe, are just so powerful. And my sense is that at least in the very short term, I would say in the next 2 to 3 years, our job in trying to attract international investors into the Global South is going to be a bit harder. On the other hand, because there's so much that needs to be done to prepare the ground, I think our challenge and our opportunity is to try to take advantage of this time to prepare better projects so that, you know, when we go to market at scale in 2 or 3 years, things can be well prepared. And we can take advantage of knowledge and technology that are developed in the richer countries so that we can get even better implementation in the Global South.
Yeah.
It's a two-way thing. I would agree. The Inflation Reduction Act is just this incredible game changer. I'm actually in DC at the moment. What Biden and the administration did with that act has made the US the standout investment target globally. Now, it's always going to be the US, of course, it's always going to be an incredibly strong investment target. But going back to the same CapEx and global market for CapEx for battery suppliers, we have assets in Texas and California, which when we switch those assets on, energize those assets, will be 30 to 40% of CapEx will be paid back to us, right? Now, for sure, the entire value chain of storage has got their hands out around that, right? So there is everybody's looking at that. But for us as an international investor, you know, forget about the decision between OECD and the Global South. We're making decisions between Germany and California and going, California is much better for us to do a deal. But I think that'll be difficult for investing in the developing world, but it should benefit in the end because we will have, I think, a consistent decrease in the CapEx given by a massive boom in, you know, investors looking to invest into building new assets, solar, wind, and storage, more factories, cheaper price, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the investment decision will become easier because CapEx will fall. But that's not today. Right, that's going to be a few years. Right now, we still see very high CapEx in storage, and so that also makes the investment case even more challenging, I think, for the Global South.
Yeah, I can say when I was making the joke earlier about bags of cash, the Biden administration's Inflation Reduction Act was more or less what I have had in mind, and I can certainly see the kind of irony in a way that we've had this promise of financial flows from the rich nations to the poorer nations for carbon finance, which have failed to materialize at scale, which makes Demetrius's job harder. And as I'd kind of paraphrase it as trying to kind of, in a way, engineer around the absence of those financial flows by thinking about the regulatory environment and be putting a relatively small amount of skin in the game. I'm also aware that the UK Chancellor has argued that we can counter the Inflation Reduction Act with our much better regulation and attraction to investors. we could spend another podcast on that. Instead, I'm going to slightly change topic because we haven't got a huge amount of time left. Demetrios, you were mentioning, you know, trillions of investment. I don't know whether the bank has a view on how much storage we need if it does come in, but I'm also keen to get, because you've got extractives in your title as well. So I'm keen to get onto this kind of often discussed thing about resource availability and we can't get enough lithium. And somebody from German TV called me up the other day and said they're going to Cornwall. They're going to go and make programs about program about tin mines in Cornwall where they're going to be finding lithium. So is this resource, you know, how much, do you know how much storage we're going to need? Are we going to run out of stuff? Any views, either of you, who wants to pick that one up?
Let me take a first quick crack. First of all, in many places in the world, there is still the potential to do more of a classic type of storage. So for instance, we calculated that for every megawatt of hydropower we can do in the Himalayas, we can have about 5 megawatts of wind and solar in India. So storage is that critical, right? If you have the storage, that is what enables wind and solar to come in. And just to reinforce one of the points that Alex made earlier, the reality is that storage went on fire when wind and solar started becoming really, really cheap. And when their marginal cost or the generation cost became actually cheaper than fuel in many cases. And we shouldn't forget that we are still in the beginning of that learning curve. People tend to believe that, yeah, but, you know, it's gone down by 90% or 80%. And they feel that, you know, there's not much space to go down. And especially because of the COVID crisis and the whole upheaval in supply chains in the world, lately we've seen an uptick in prices. So people feel that, you know, maybe there's no more space to reduce costs. I am strongly convinced that costs will keep on going down the more we see deployment happening. So this learning curve will still keep on going. And when that happens, then what I also expect to see is that we will see new technologies on storage developing, and they will also start going into a learning curve. So in an optimistic scenario and in an idealized world, we should get to net zero almost painless, because we should be able to get at some point where the costs of technology will be really so low that it'll be the rational thing to do. And I think if we didn't have a lot of the geopolitics and the conflicts around the world that we're seeing now, I think this is likely in some ways to delay things, in other ways to accelerate things. But for sure, it puts additional uncertainty in the system and the projections, and that makes everyone's guesses a bit more difficult. But I think, and if there's one conclusion that we have in the bank and we keep on pushing for, is that no matter what you do, no matter what kind of things you want to promote, always continue to support wind and solar. Because we need the investments on wind and solar to keep on going. We need these learning curves to be pushing things down. And this will again drag in and pull in additional cost reductions, I think both in the batteries, definitely on hydrogen, and everything else. Now, to come to your question, Rob, on do we have enough material? I think technologies will change. And as technologies change, we see that the efficiency of materials improves and improves and improves. So if you look, for instance, on how much cobalt was going into the first lithium ion batteries that went into the first Teslas, is about more than 5, maybe sometimes up 7-8 times what it goes now. So cobalt, which was a very concentrated material coming only from one place and with a lot of difficulties, we see that technologies found out that this is highly risky, becoming expensive, uncertainties with it, technologies moved away. This is likely to happen with almost everything. If there's one thing that I believe is going to be a challenge, and it's going to be a challenge because it takes a long time to establish mines and start extraction, is copper. And we've done estimates on that, and we feel that copper is a something that we need to pay attention to. And on the other side, copper is a great opportunity for many can't have copper, and they could use it to develop the infrastructure and go into volume extraction. So again, as you said, probably this merits a different podcast, but in summary, I think the materials are definitely there. Lithium is abundant. The question is, how quickly can you get it out? And the question is, how quickly and environmentally and in an environmentally responsible way can you get it out? And I think, again, this can be dealt with. It will require attention. And what we should make sure that it is managed well is the balance. How do we still keep on moving fast? Permits are given and things are moving forward, while at the same time we try to anticipate the really big risks that come with the environmental type of effects that we have with mining, and make sure that we can mine in a way that it is it can be remediated. And of course, we need to push more and more on recycling everything.
Yeah. Okay. Alex, any?
All of our assets. So, you know, we have 1.2 gigs in our portfolios, all lithium ion. That is only because lithium ion is a very good solution for the things that we are doing with our assets. And they're being manufactured, the batteries being manufactured by tier one manufacturers who, you know, will give us guarantees on performance and the like. I remember, because I'm old, times in the solar world in 2010, 11, where people were talking about there isn't enough materials, there's going to be price spikes and things like that. You know, these companies with very sophisticated supply chains will find the right materials and be able to deliver them. I also believe that there is a range of new technologies which can do different things. So, for instance, you know, lithium ion is not a good solution for long duration, right? And we do need long duration storage. It's a critical part of our transition. And so, whether that will be, you know, flow batteries, whether it be some other types of technology, we're happy to invest if we can see the investment case. So, you know, I agree. I think there is enough materials. Some of them are absolutely in very problematic parts of the world. I mean, you mentioned cobalt. Majority of the cobalt comes from Democratic Republic of Congo, which is very problematic in terms of, you know, treatment of people and environmental concerns. We just recently signed up to the Cobalt Alliance to see how we can help and be part of the solution. Absolutely. The market, I believe, will deliver a set of new technologies and existing technologies at cheaper and cheaper price, right? Because that's what we've seen all through our history. And then for us as investors, we look at that, we understand what different solutions can add into different markets and be able to make those decisions. But it is about that innovation, right? I think it is quite interesting when you think about solar. I was an investor in a whole range of different solar technologies, none of which, to be honest, actually got anywhere, right? And what we have in the solar market today is a technology which is decades and decades old, but has been scaled up with really excellent manufacturing expertise from the Asian manufacturers and giving us a cheaper and cheaper cost per watt. Lithium ion is, again, a decades old technology which has been scaled up. As an energy storage investor, to be honest, on that side, we're a price taker. 95% of the battery market is for the EVs. 5% is for energy storage. So until there becomes a technology which is more dedicated to storage and more applicable to storage, we're really at the whims of what is happening in the EV market. But I think that market manufacturing capacity will continue to increase. And though we've had price spikes over the last few years, I think they're plateauing now, and I think they will resume a downward trend as more capacity comes on stream.
Okay, so it sounds as though you're both pretty optimistic about the combination of innovation and in the technologies themselves and innovation in the supply chain to continue to deliver the storage products that we're going to need. I think I know the answer to this one, but very briefly, are you both optimistic about our potential to make progress with greening our power grids? Alex?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at the things that we need to address, energy has been a huge success story. And I think it has challenges, but it needs to continue. But I do think we're on a very good track on that. I would have a different answer if you asked me about heat or transportation. But on energy, I think we're doing a good job.
We'll come back to heat and transportation another day. Demetrios, you're one of the most optimistic people I know. So but please give us your thoughts on this.
As you know, I believe optimism, you know, is a strategy, and you have to be optimistic if you're dealing with development. The only shade or shadow that concerns me is that I see something developing which we should look out for and see how it will evolve. But what I say is that there seems to be an increasing political separation between the right and the left when it comes to fossil fuels. And if that becomes more acute, it is not good news for the net zero trajectories, because what that will do is it will introduce additional uncertainties for investors. And every time uncertainty goes up, what happens is that the cost of capital goes up. So for a business like clean energy, where the cost of capital is really, really important, if we see that somehow, rather than everyone agreeing that the planet is in danger and we have to find ways to move towards net zero in the best way as possible and in the fastest way as possible, if this becomes a political issue which is used to polarize the population, I think this kind of concerns me. My optimism is still that when it comes to the new generation, you know, my kids and younger people, I don't think that they're falling for this yet. But I think this is something that we need to keep an eye on, because if it really develops and it becomes more intense, then it has a chance of derailing a little bit investors themselves. And I think that could give us all trouble.
Yeah, the politics are everything. Thank you both for even the beginning of a conversation around this very, very complex topic of energy storage and greening our grids. Thanks to my guests, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about UKERC, you can visit our website at www.ukerc.ac.uk.